from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's the morning after, and the shockwaves from yesterday's Supreme Court health decision are still rippling across the country. This morning on Forum, we focus on what's next, what the court's decision means for healthcare in California, a state that had a lot at stake in yesterday's ruling. That's because California has nearly 7 million residents who are uninsured, the most of any state in the union. In the hour ahead, we'll look at what lies ahead, and we'll take any and all questions about what the new law entails, from the new health care insurance exchanges to what it means for people with pre-existing conditions. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. One of the interesting consequences of yesterday's Supreme Court ruling on health care is that besides all of the politics and all of the legal arguments, we've actually started talking about what the bill might actually mean for consumers. How will the law, now that it's passed judicial review, affect American families? How will going to the doctor be different? How will getting a doctor be different? Who will benefit from expanded coverage? And who may still be left behind? The answers to those questions impact California perhaps more than any other state in the country. We have more uninsured, nearly 7 million, and will receive more of the new federal largesse. But that also means California will have to be ready to hit the mark when all of the law's various components come into play. Joining us this hour to talk about that, Dr. Andrew Beinman. He's professor of medicine and health policy and director of the University of California's Medicaid Research Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. He also helped work on drafting the law when he worked in Congress a few years back. Dr. Beinman, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Betsy Imholz. She is Special Projects Director and an expert on health policy working for Consumers Union. Betsy Imholz, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And Emily Bazar joins us as well. She's senior writer at the California Healthcare Foundation's Center for Health Reporting at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications. Emily Bazar, thanks for joining us as well.
Sure thing, Dave.
So let's start with how ready we are, Emily Bazar. I mean, we've seen a lot in the last 24 hours about that California is sort of well-positioned, has a lot at stake, but is also well-positioned to take advantage of the law as it rolls out and goes into effect. What's foremost in that? What is California ready to do? Where does it need to go to get more ready for what's to come?
You're right. California is very well-positioned. California has a head start in implementation, if you will. The state has been very aggressive at implementing the law since it passed in 2010. Since then, the legislature has adopted many measures to implement and, in some cases, to broaden the federal overhaul. And some of these things are measures that touch Californians' lives very directly already. One measure many people know about allow young adults between the ages of 19 to 26 to remain on their parents' health insurance policies. And the federal government estimated that earlier this month that 435,000 Californians are taking advantage of that. So there are already hundreds of thousands of Californians who are taking advantage of some of the provisions of the law. And as I said, the state has aggressively moved to implement it and wasn't really waiting for what the Supreme Court was going to decide. It's interesting, at the end of May, the health benefit exchange, California was the first to set up its exchange, the health benefit exchange awarded a contract worth nearly $360 million to a company to set up the website and enrollment system so Californians can start shopping at the end of next year for insurance policies under the exchange. And I guess what the ruling means for California is that this pace of implementation is just going to accelerate. When I spoke to lawmakers yesterday, the Democratic lawmakers at least, the three words I kept hearing over and over were full speed ahead.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that are in place now already and sort of how that will move forward in the months ahead. Joining us to give us a bit of an update on that is Dave Jones. He is the state's insurance commissioner. Commissioner Jones, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's talk first about what we just heard from Emily Bazar about the things the state has already done to be in place for what's going to happen, and the health insurance exchange in particular. Explain what the health insurance exchange will provide, first of all, when it comes into effect in 2014.
The exchange will be an internet-based marketplace where individuals and small businesses can go to compare insurance products and HMO products in a apples-to-apples way that allows them to compare on price. It will provide for different levels of products cost-sharing, and it will provide for a baseline of benefits in all the plans and insurance products that are sold in the exchange. The hope is that the exchange will use its buying power on behalf of 4 to 5 million Californians to negotiate better prices for the exchange and for individuals who buy in the exchange. In addition, folks who are between 133% and 400% of the federal poverty level will be able to take advantage of a refundable federal tax credit that will be applied towards the premium that they would otherwise pay for the health insurance, and that will help defray the cost of the insurance.
So let's explain that a bit further, because I was not aware of that, honestly, until I was sort of reading up on things last night, that you can get subsidy help for health insurance if you make as much as I understand it, $92,000 a year for a family of four. Is that right? So it really provides a lot of support well beyond just the very poor.
That's correct. For those who make up to 400% of the federal poverty level, which in California is about $98,000 for a family of four, you'll be eligible for a declining scale federal tax credit, which will be applied towards the premium that you would pay for product in the exchange. So just to take an example, say, for a product for a family of four, a family that's making $93,000, if you assume that their annual unsubsidized premium would be about $14,200, they'd get a tax credit worth $5,344. So their premium after the tax credit would be about $8,900, which is essentially $742 a month. So it does provide a significant subsidy. The roll-up value of that subsidy to California is about $6 billion on a going-forward basis. And then the other critical component of the Affordable Care Act that will help the uninsured is the provision that allows us to expand eligibility for Medi-Cal to single adults and to individuals up to 133% of the federal poverty level. The value of that federal subsidy is calculated to be about $9 billion, and that will help about 1.5 million Californians who don't currently have insurance be eligible for Medi-Cal and get insurance for themselves and their families.
But back to the exchange for just a moment, and then I want to follow up with you about Medi-Cal as well. Is the exchange open to anyone or only those who qualify for some sort of subsidy?
The exchange is open to anyone, but the subsidy is limited to those
right.
At 400% of the federal poverty level, and appropriately so. I mean, I think the idea is to help those who have the greatest need.
But anybody, no matter their means, can use the exchange as a way of doing good comparison shopping, correct?
Yes, and I think the other important note to make here, though, is that while there are extraordinary benefits in the Affordable Care Act for those who currently have health insurance and for those who don't have health insurance, there is a big missing piece of the Affordable Care Act, and that is any direct authority to reject ever-rising excessive rate increases. And that is not an authority that currently exists in state law nor in federal law. It's an authority I've been fighting to try to get both legislatively and through a ballot measure that's been submitted for qualification. But it is a missing component of reform and one we need to fill.
So just staying with that point for a moment, one of the things that I think has been perplexing about people over the last 2 years since the bill was passed is that insurance has continued to go up. So there's nothing that's magically going to change that. You're saying that authority is still needed for your office or some way of containing costs. Does that mean then that no matter what happens, costs, health premiums will continue to rise?
I think the exchange will help to bend the premium price curve down a bit. But I am concerned that even with the aggregated buying power of the exchange, it won't be sufficient to dramatically de-escalate the rising rates of health insurance premiums. And maybe the best example of that is what happened recently with CalPERS, which is one of the largest large groups in the country. They just announced that they had to agree to a 9.6% average rate increase for their members. And so I think it's a caution with regard to whether we will get all of the promised benefits out of the Affordable Care Act without this missing piece. And Massachusetts provides another example. Of course, despite Mitt Romney's protestations to the contrary, he led the effort in 2005 to implement the Affordable Care Act in Massachusetts. They did all of the things that are in our Affordable Care Act, guaranteed issue, individual mandate, a subsidized pool or exchange, and yet prices continue to climb through the roof. And so after 4 years of that, the governor of Massachusetts announced that he was empowering his insurance commissioner to actually directly regulate the rates, declaring it the missing piece of the healthcare reform. And my views aren't unique in this regard. Senator Dianne Feinstein has come to the same conclusion after her years of study of both this reform and healthcare markets.
Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones joining us this morning. Commissioner Jones, I know you have to run, but thanks for getting us started in our conversation this morning.
My pleasure, and thanks so very much for convening such a great group to talk about the important announcement of the Supreme Court yesterday and our efforts to move forward with health care reform.
Commissioner Dave Jones. Dr. Andrew Beinman, let's pick up on that for a moment about the cost provisions. I know you work specifically on Medi-Cal, and we'll get to that and expand our conversation to include that part of it in particular. But it does seem like a missing link, that there are lots of carrots, there are lots of nice things, but there aren't necessarily a lot of hammers to contain costs. Is that a fair criticism that we just heard from Commissioner Jones?
Well, it is certainly one of the things that has been raised about the Affordable Care Act. Many people would characterize this new law as bringing the majority of our population under the tent of health care coverage. And then maybe once we're all under the tent, there will be more opportunities to have conversations about how do we more effectively bring down the cost of care. But I think in addition to the things that the insurance commissioner raised, the law does actually also call for a number of ways of changing the healthcare delivery system that could also help us to try to control costs. So, for example, you're hearing terms like accountable care organizations and primary care medical homes, bundled payments. A lot of the focus is on how do we pay healthcare providers, physicians, hospitals, and so forth, and is our fee-for-service system part of the problem that's been driving costs in some ways? And if we change that payment mechanism, could we bring those costs under better control?
So in other words, this question of paying for outcomes rather than the actual service itself. So the rewarding physicians who deliver improved outcomes, not just for performing a particular service. Is that at the heart of what you're saying? And how will that play out now?
Well, that's certainly a piece of it, that we absolutely want to reinforce and reward better outcomes and not just the performance of an activity. I mean, you wouldn't be happy if you were paying your car mechanic just for doing activities, but at the end of the experience, your car wasn't working as you hoped it would be. So we want to make sure that the payment is aligned with achieving the best outcomes. But I think separate from that, it also has to do with not just reinforcing lots of activities, but perhaps giving resources for expected costs for certain activities. So a classic example might be something like a hip replacement, in which we can anticipate, well, you need a pre-operative evaluation, you need the actual surgery, and then there's a predicted amount of rehabilitation that most patients will go through. And without complications, we can anticipate that amount of money. And so rather than paying piecemeal for each aspect of it that could, in fact, expand some of the costs, if we give fixed amounts for expected performance and for high performance, that could, in fact, create a different set of incentives that will hopefully allow providers to work in a more integrated way together to achieve the best outcomes at the lowest cost.
Betsy Imholz at the Consumers Union, as you look at this from a consumer's point of view, both in terms of cost, but in terms of what people will now be able to access, what are some of the things that you're focusing on that you think that consumers need to be aware of so that they can get the best coverage for the amount of money they have?
Well, Consumers Union views this as a huge victory for consumers to finally give people some peace of mind and certainty about what they'll be able to get in terms of coverage. You know, think of seriously ill children who will be able to get their critical care, young adults, as Emily mentioned, who are able to stay on their parents' insurance now, seniors who can better afford prescription drugs. But going forward, we are especially especially looking here in California at the exchange as a critical opportunity to improve the comparability of data that consumers can use to make their healthcare decisions. And in fact,
what does that mean, comparability of data?
Well, today, if you go out into the insurance market, if you don't have coverage through your employer or through a public program, you go out and try to find a policy, and it's really impossible to figure out what you're getting and to compare policies one to the other. The forms are full of fine print, and I think consumers all feel like there's a lot of sort of gotchas involved. Hopefully, a lot of that will be gone in 2014 because people with pre-existing conditions and will be able to get coverage without what we call medical underwriting about their prior conditions, et cetera. But in addition, the information needs to be available in a very plain language way so that people can, in a standardized way, so that people can really make good comparisons amongst policies, find out who the provider network is. They may care particularly about staying with their doctor. And ideally, at bottom, we hope the exchange will be able to use its bargaining power to leverage good rates.
So is this a bit like, to use Dr. Byman's analogy of the automobile, you can go right now, if you're shopping for an automobile, you can compare mileage per gallon standards from a Honda to a Toyota to a Cadillac or whatever and make a determination about that. Is that the kind of comparability you're talking about?
That is very similar to that. And, of course, that's what Consumer Reports does. That's my organization.
Right.
That we try to take that complicated information and make it simple, and that's what we hope the exchange will do as well. The Affordable Care Act itself has a lot of provisions that require better data gathering and provision by providers and insurers to make it more standard. It's incredible. If you start to look at all the money that's spent in the healthcare system, it's still very difficult to get comprehensive, good, clear data to make those comparisons, but that should be improving.
And Emily Bazar, bring us up to date again about the readiness of this exchange. Will people shortly be able to start poking around on that exchange and begin to assess this, even though it won't be fully operational until 2014?
The goal, I think, of the exchange is to let people start poking around, as you say, starting next October. So basically, it would be open for an open enrollment period in October 2013. That's what Kim Belshea, she's a board member of the exchange. I talked with her yesterday. She said that's what they're hoping for. So people could go and start shopping around at that point, and then they could start signing up or applying for coverage that would begin on January 1st, 2014. So that's all in process right now, and they're kind of madly trying to figure out what kind of benefits, for instance, should be offered or should be standard, you know, in the plans, what kind of media campaign they should do to let people know about this. I'm willing to bet that most Californians don't even have any idea what the exchange is.
No, I think I mentioned in the opening of this program, one of the interesting things about now that the court has ruled is that there probably will be more conversation now about what's actually in the bill than we've had over the past couple of years. Let's widen out our conversation and talk some about a crucial part of this, Andy Byman, and that is the role of the expansion of Medicaid or Medi-Cal here in California. We have 7 million approximately, no one knows exactly, uninsured in this state. How will the expansion of Medicaid to Medi-Cal here in California cut down that number of uninsured?
Right. So in the way that the Affordable Care Act was designed, it was anticipated that about half of the expansion of coverage would happen through the exchange, which we've been talking about, and about half through the Medicaid programs. And the Medicaid programs are partnership programs between the federal government and the state government. As the program is currently designed, here in California, about half of the funding for that comes from the federal government and half comes from the state. With the new expansion populations, it's estimated that about probably in the vicinity of about 1.5 million Californians who are currently uninsured will now become eligible for the Medi-Cal program.
And all that money will come from, at least initially, from the federal government. And what the court ruled yesterday was that what the law, which had said you got to take it or you're out of the Medicaid system entirely, can't happen. It's now a choice. But can you? It's hard to imagine, in a way, a state saying, no, no thank you. We don't want X billion dollars.
Right. So a very important point. The federal government, in the case of expanding who is eligible for the Medi-Cal program here in California, will completely pay for that expansion during the first 3 years of its implementation. And then over several years, that a contribution will taper down to no less than 90% several years out. So the federal government is the main provider of this expansion. But you're absolutely right. The court did rule that if the state did not want to take up that option, that the penalty for that would not be to take away all the historical amount of Medicaid money that went to the state.
So I'm trying to get my arms around who this will now affect. If the healthcare exchanges allow a certain population of people who are of more modest means but not really poor get insurance or get subsidized insurance in some way, who does this larger expansion of Medicaid embrace that wasn't under the tent before?
Right. So the key issue here is that many people understand that the Medicaid program is designed to help take care of the poorest in our society. But what has happened is the way the program historically was designed is that you also had to fit a certain category. You either had to be, for example, a low-income child or a pregnant mother or to have a disability. The main group that was left out historically from the Medicaid program were adults who did not have children. And so you can imagine couples who did not have children, who were low income, were not eligible. What will happen under the Affordable Care Act is that everyone up to 133% of the federal poverty level will be covered completely at government cost to be on the Medicaid program. And those individuals will not be entering into the exchange, as we were just talking about, but will receive their health care coverage through the Medicaid program.
And back to you, Emily Bazar, on how ready the state is for this. I mean, this is a gargantuan expansion. Are we ready to sort of suddenly enroll a couple of million people?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that, but California does already have a kind of interim expansion in place, and it's colloquially known as the bridge to reform. So nearly 50 counties are participating in this interim expansion. It's an $8 billion program. And what it is in these counties, they're early, before 2014, when the Medicaid expansion happens nationally, these counties are expanding eligibility in the ways that Dr. Beinman just described, you know, to childless adults, or they're increasing the amount of money you can make to be eligible for Medi-Cal. And right now, there are at least 360,000 Californians who are participating in this. For sure, it's going to be a huge challenge to take on this new population of people in Medicaid. California is trying with this bridge to reform, and it'll be important to keep an eye on that to see how it does.
And we're about to go to a break, Dr. Beinman, but how ready are your colleagues for that big expansion? Because traditionally, a lot of doctors haven't been very enthusiastic about taking on more Medicaid patients.
Well, I think this is a really important issue you put your finger on, which is we are talking about coverage expansion. But if fundamentally we want to improve access to care, which is really our goal here, then we do need to have providers who are available and ready to take this insurance coverage. California does have a very robust network of clinics, which has been an important source of providing care. But yes, we do have a difficulty of getting a large number of our physicians to participate in the program.
We'll pick up on that question when we return. We also want to get into the question of pre-existing conditions, a key part of this bill, and what that will mean for people as we go forward, and talk about a variety of other things that are included in the new Affordable Health Care Act. Well, not so new, but now one that has passed muster from the Supreme Court. We'll take your questions at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. What are you concerned about with the new law? What are you thinking about as you go forward? What are your questions about healthcare coverage? We'll take those up when we come back. You can email us too at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, What's next? Now some 24 hours after the Supreme Court ruled that the Affordable Care Act was indeed constitutional. Joining us to talk about that, Dr. Andrew Beinman. He worked on the creation of the law in Congress. He's also professor of medicine and health policy and director of the University of California's Medicaid Research Institute. Emily Bazar joins us as well. She's with the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting, and Betsy Imholtz, the Special Projects Director at the Consumers Union and an expert on health policy. Number of questions coming in, and let's just start right in by going through those. A couple of emails first, and then we'll get to your calls. You can join us, by the way, at 866-733-6786. Email us at form@kqed.org. Betsy Imholtz, Keith writes in, please clarify the provision of the under 26 remaining on their parents' policy. Will the company or government entity paying for the parents' policy also have to pay for the child, or does the child Or does the family have to pay for keeping their children being covered? Can you clarify for us what that means? Because that's something that's in effect now, right? That kids can stay on their parents' policy till age 26.
That's correct. It went into effect, and we had a California law that implemented that. There may be a slight increase in premium for that coverage. But my recollection, I'm sorry I don't have that one right in front of me, but my recollection is that there may be some employer continued contribution on that, but there may be a slight increase in parental policy because of it.
Emily Bazar, can you add anything about what the costs will be to keep kids on your policy up to age 26?
Unfortunately, like Betsy, I don't have the particulars. My understanding, though, is that some of the costs would be forwarded to the parents and to the family.
Okay, Keith, thanks for the call. We'll see if we can get a little more detail for you. Lucy writes in, what will the coverage options be for undocumented immigrants as of 2014? I imagine, Dr. Beinman, this is one of the reasons why we're not entirely, we see specific numbers varying from, we have 5 million uninsured to 7 million uninsured. I assume the undocumented plays a part of that, and how will that factor into the Medicaid expansion?
Right. So it's anticipated when the Congressional Budget Office did their estimates of how many people would be covered under the Affordable Care Act, they anticipated a couple of different groups that would not ultimately get coverage, and people who are here undocumented is a substantial part of that, at least a third and maybe more. So overall, we anticipate the population to be about 94% will be covered by the time the Affordable Care Act is in place. Now, people who are undocumented, there will be some regional differences in what their experiences are. Certainly here in California, we anticipate that some of our safety net providers, public hospitals, will remain critical places where people can go for care. The Medicaid law is also written in a way that if individuals, regardless of their documentation status, come to emergency departments for true emergent problems, that these individuals do get covered under an emergency Medicaid coverage. So that would not help them with ongoing chronic care. So if they had diabetes and needed to have checkups with their primary care doctor, it would not be covered that way. But if they had emergency problems and came to emergency departments, there would be a provision in the Medicaid program already that would cover some of those costs.
Lucy, who wrote in that question, also had a follow-up, which ties directly to what you're just saying, which is whether or not the new law will affect the obligations of hospitals to care for everyone. Does that now change so that people will say, well, wait a minute, you should be covered by a health care exchange or by the new expansion of Medicaid?
Right. So there's nothing explicitly that changes those obligations of not-for-profit hospitals and so forth to continue to provide community service in exchange for their having a reduction in their payment of taxes. Now, there are some specific dollars that the federal government provides to the state called disproportionate share hospital dollars, which go to hospitals that have historically taken care of underserved populations. As part of this law, the federal government will be phasing down the amount that they target toward those hospitals with the understanding that, well, many of these people will now gain insurance coverage, and so we don't need that separate flow of funds. But this will create some challenges.
So a hospital like San Francisco General, for example, might well get less money than it used to under that, but presumably it'll be covered in a new way?
Yes, that's exactly right. Now, of course, this the logistics and the details of this needs to be followed closely because, yes, San Francisco General will lose some of its direct funding under the disproportionate share hospital federal funding. But as long as it does a good job of retaining a significant number of its patient population or attracting new individuals with coverage, that should help to backfill those lost finances.
Into our calls. Becky joins us first from Palo Alto. Becky, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I have recently had the experience of having to get my own health insurance when my COBRA insurance was coming to an end. And I found, well, first, the brokers, I think their main goal is to sell you insurance. So I'm really glad that's going away because I don't think they really took the time to make sure that I would be eligible for what I got. But the second thing is that I called a couple places, including Kaiser, and they said directly because of this new law, they are no longer offering family plans. I think to get around that, if you have a family plan, you know, and your kid is over 21 or whatever, you have to cover them. So they actually told me, no, we don't have family plans. So I wonder, I haven't heard about that in the news. But
okay. Let's see if we can get an answer. Betsy Imholtz, can you respond?
Yeah, I've not heard anything about that, about family plans. One thing, the point about brokers is that through the new system, there'll be something called navigators, and the exchange itself, of course, will have its own sort of a consumer assistance function. So it won't be necessary to go through brokers anymore because I completely understand your perspective that it often feels like a broker is trying to lead you to a particular thing where the commission structure might be favorable. They can be very helpful, of course, to small businesses especially, but some folks have not had the greatest individual experiences with brokers. I don't know about the family plan issue, though.
Dr.
I did
Bynum,
want to add one.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
One thing, Dave, if I may.
Yeah.
On the young adult coverage question that came up earlier,
yeah,
the answer to that one I've just found, which is that employers, if you're getting the continued coverage through an employer plan, they will contribute to the young adult coverage up until age 23, but they're not required beyond age 23
okay
to contribute.
Thanks.
But our anecdotal experience has been that has not increased premiums much.
Okay, thank you for that. Dr. Bynum, anything more for Becky's question on companies doing away with family coverage, as she's reporting she's heard from one insurer in particular?
Yeah.
There's nothing in the law that would discourage that,
no,
right?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, Becky, thanks. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. David, go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. I was an employee at a company for a long time and had Kaiser through them, and I was happy with the coverage. And then I went off into business for myself in 2007, at which time I thought, okay, I'll just apply for Kaiser as an individual. And I was denied off of something that really surprised me. Was I had fallen at one point about 8 years ago and hurt my neck, and they said due to the neck injury, I was not eligible. I protested it a few times. It took me about three times going back and forth and having doctors write me notes, and they did bring me back on. But since then, my wife actually is an attorney at a law firm, and they would offer to put me on her coverage. I've been too kind of concerned to let go of my Kaiser, which is about $450 a month, to join hers. It would save us a ton of money, knowing that she may not work there forever. And what happens then if she stops working and I have to reapply to Kaiser? Am I
right?
Is this a good time for me to finally take
right
a deep breath and say I can save $450
yeah
a month, join her plan, and I'll get back on?
Great question, David. And it brings us right to something important that we have to get to and have not yet, which is the pre-existing condition question. Let's look at this in two ways. And Emily Bazar, why don't you start us out? Because this is another one of the bridge areas that California has embarked on early, right, to give people who were not able to get insurance because of a pre-existing condition a chance to get that insurance. So how is that working so far? And then lead us into what comes next.
Yes, it is a limited group of people, though. So basically, California and some other states who wanted to were given federal money after the law was adopted, the federal law was adopted, to create a high-risk insurance pool. And this pool is available to people who have pre-existing conditions and who had been denied coverage because of those pre-existing conditions, and who here's the thing that gets people, though, who haven't been insured for the previous 6 months. So the caller wouldn't be eligible for
right
this Right, and so that's a big difficulty. I think it's a big obstacle in getting onto this plan. People don't want to let go for 6 months, you know, if they have insurance. But in any case, so this pool does provide insurance to people who can meet the eligibility requirements. And right now, there are about 11,500 Californians in this pool. It is the largest pool in the country like this. Initially, I did some reporting on this at the very beginning. People were hesitant to say how many they thought would be on this plan, but there was a hope, I think, that it would be more than what has actually happened.
So for the Davids of the world, Dr. Andy Beinman, what comes next? Because now he won't have that worry, right? David's feeling stuck. He's got insurance, but he's afraid to move or change because who knows if he'll get back on. That worry now goes away come 2014. Is that correct?
That's right. So it's right around the corner. We can almost taste it at this point. But come 2014, there will be provisions of the law that take effect so that, for example, Dave won't be able to be denied for pre-existing conditions. There has to be guaranteed issue of health insurance coverage. And the amount, in fact, that is charged for that insurance cannot take these historical conditions, rightly or wrongly applied, and the condition that was described in this circumstances even sounds so marginal as it is, but that could not be used to then create dramatically increased prices for the health insurance. We are all put into a much more closely aligned pool that will, yes, take a little bit of account of our age, but there won't be this gigantic differences between those who are deemed as perfectly healthy and those who have had any health conditions. So it is coming, and it's an important part of the law in 2014.
But not to be an apologist for the insurance industry or anything, but in a way, isn't there a logical argument that for not in David's circumstance so much, because as you describe, it sounds like not something that is overly – but if someone has – you know, a really serious health condition and is likely going to be a huge consumer of healthcare providing, why shouldn't that person have to pay more?
Well, this is a great point and is really fundamentally why it was so important that the individual mandate and all the things came together the way they did in the discussion yesterday at the Supreme Court. So it has been, you know, many of us have viewed for a long time that we don't want to be excluding those people who have health problems from the health insurance pool. And yet the problem has been that the individuals who have pursued health insurance, of course, know something about how sick they are and therefore tend to be sicker and have higher costs. And that's what health insurance industry has said. Of course, that's why we have to charge more money. By having the individual mandate and bringing everyone into the pool, the healthy and the sick, that gives health insurance companies much more of an ability to share the costs across everybody and make the relative price for everyone much more reasonable. And that's really what's at the heart of this law.
Question from Pam that comes in via email. She writes in, my husband and I have a small business, and our insurance is very small business-like. It only includes very catastrophic, very expensive. Would we be able to use the insurance exchange to get a better plan? What about that, Betsy? Can small business owners shop on the exchange?
Yes, and it's good to use the word shop because that's exactly what the name of the small business part of the exchange is going to be. That's not available yet, but currently today there are available tax credits for small employers that want to provide coverage for their employees but find it overly expensive. A good place to look for more detailed information on that is smallbusinessmajority.org. That's an organization that helps small businesses with their health care and on the policy side as well. But it's a good place to look. They've got a calculator on there to help you figure out if you're in a small business, how the small business can participate.
Here's a question about the fine or the tax. We learned yesterday from the Supreme Court that indeed this is a tax. Bill writes in, how are the fines implemented? Is that through the income tax? Does that mean that if someone who doesn't file income taxes shows up for care, will they then be contacted by the IRS? Interesting question. Betsy Imhals, do you know?
Yeah, it will be implemented through the IRS tax system. But if you don't file, no, they're not coming looking for you. Those folks are just not subject to it. So that's the short answer. And it's some people feel like a very small fine or tax the first year, $90 for an adult and half of that for a child. And it goes up steadily, but not too far over time.
What about that, Andy Beinman, in terms of the amount? Because it doesn't really at all pay for what insurance would be. So it's sort of a nominal amount, isn't it?
Yeah, but if you stop and think about it, you would end up paying a penalty or the tax, as you say, but not getting the benefit of the product. And so in a sense, when an individual will be faced with is, okay, I could purely pay a tax but in fact not get the benefit of health insurance, or I could pay a little bit more, avoid that tax, and in fact have the benefit of something that's really useful in my life, health insurance, to give me the security of being able to go to a physician or a hospital when I get sick.
Back to our calls. Cynthiel joins us in Fremont next. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I have two questions. One, how does the coverage provided by the exchange stack against the ones that are currently provided by the private insurance through employers? Like, I'm basically employed by a company and they provide insurance. How does it stack against it? Number two, I have friends and relatives who work in agriculture farms. How is this going to help the people who is actually making $9 an hour? Can they actually afford to pay? Would they be able to get a family coverage? And what would be the cost be like?
And I'm sorry, Cynthia, could you repeat your first question, please? Because I missed the first part of what you said.
Yeah, I am currently employed in a private organization. They actually provide me insurance. So now the exchange, whatever the coverage that it provides, how does it stack against in terms of coverage against the one that is provided by private employers?
Okay, thanks for the call. Stay with us, and we'll try to get some answers for you. Emily Bazar, the exchange, again, would be open to everyone, right? You wouldn't be limited necessarily. Is that correct? What about Cynthiel's question?
You know, Dr. Beinman may be better to answer this question, or Betsy, either of them.
Yeah.
But
okay.
My understanding is that this exchange is in the process of choosing what the baseline plan is going to be, what the benefits are going to be that the plans have to offer on the exchange. Betsy, can you take it from here?
Yeah, that question is being debated in two places. One is in the legislature, which is looking at bills that would define what we call essential health benefits. And they're looking at a comparable a small business plan offered by Kaiser. And the federal law lays out the different categories, 10 different categories of benefits that must be covered. I think the bottom line is, for the caller, I think it will be very comparable to what you're getting from your employer. There may be some variation in there as to cost sharing. The exchange itself will be looking at this, you're right, Emily, over the next year as well, figuring out what will be the criteria that they'll use in choosing plans, and then what tiers will be available and cost-sharing benefits, et cetera.
And Cynthia's second question, Dr. Beinman, I believe, was, you know, for the person who's making $9 an hour, where does that person go? Will they fall outside of Medicaid but could fall within the exchange, subsidized exchange?
Right. So first of all, one of the issues will be if that individual through work has an opportunity to get insurance through their work that provides them with a good way for them to get health insurance benefits, that may end up being their best option. However, if that's not available to them through their employer, then they absolutely can then go through an enrollment process to either determine are they going to be eligible for Medicaid, or will their income limits be above that but eligible for some of those federal subsidies that Dave Jones talked about at the beginning of this program. And so there's everyone will have a mechanism to be able to get insurance. And again, if you're on the lower end of the income scale, that's when the federal government, either through Medicaid or through subsidies, will help you get it.
Cynthiel, thanks so much for the call.
Yeah,
go ahead, please.
Emily here. Thank you. At the beginning of the conversation, as Dr. Beinman just said, Dave Jones alluded to how much a family of four would have to pay per month for that, if a family of four making 400% of the federal poverty level would have to pay $742 on the exchange under this modeling program that they've done. But to address your caller's question, for somebody who's making 150% of the federal poverty level with a family of four, that premium would go down to $117
a
month.
Wow.
Because the subsidies increase for the lower income.
Yeah, okay. That's very helpful. Thanks for adding that in, Emily. Couple of questions coming in on whether or not there are going to be enough doctors to do this. We talked about that briefly before the break, about whether or not doctors were going to be keen on this idea of more Medicaid patients. But two questions on this. Presently, there are not enough doctors and clinics available to treat Medicaid patients. Why do the bill's sponsors believe that there will be an increase in the number of doctors and clinics sufficient to treat those new patients? And then along with that, Francis asked the question, could the AMA require that doctors participate in these programs?
Right. So there are some significant questions that we need to look at here in California and around the country in terms of the availability of physicians and other healthcare professionals. There are many people who are going to gain coverage who have put off health problems in coming to healthcare because of financial barriers and so forth. So by gaining coverage, they will come into the system. Now, historically, only about 55 or 60% of physicians across the state of California have been available and willing to take on Medicaid patients. And so that, in fact, could be a barrier. One of the things that is known is that there are real regional differences in the availability of doctors. We're quite fortunate, as an example, here in San Francisco to have quite a significant number of physicians. It's not to say that we couldn't benefit by having more primary care physicians and so forth, but in general, we are in a very good position. In the Central Valley of California, it's very well known that there are very significant shortages, and the coverage expansion will actually particularly hit those parts of the state because that's where large numbers of individuals are uninsured.
So the very places that are the neediest may have the biggest problem in having available physicians. Does that mean that there needs to be some work done in your profession? I mean, we read about more doctors sort of taking on the kind of boutique approach to practicing medicine. I'm not even going to take insurance. Just pay me what I want. I mean, it sounds like there needs to be some lobbying efforts that you could do, among, not you personally, but amongst your colleagues.
Well, I think there's a number of things. First of all, there are still many, many medical students coming who are interested to become doctors who share these values. There have been some real challenges with some of the alignment of incentives, of payment that has reinforced certain kinds of practices that have in fact drawn a lot of people away from fulfilling that social mission. So there are things in the bill that are aimed to try to in fact induce physicians back to that kind of role. The other thing that the Affordable Care Act does that I just want to mention is it invests over $10 billion across the country in building more safety net clinics to, in fact, be put in these areas where there's the greatest need for more providers. And so that will also be an important boost of expanding our capacity.
And back to our calls. Felix in San Francisco is – I'm sorry, Felix. I jumped to Denise instead. I'll get to you, Felix, I promise. Denise, go ahead.
Yes, I'm an orthopedic surgeon in a multi-specialty group here in the Bay Area. And already the group I'm with takes all insurance, you know, all the way down to Medicare or Medicaid. And I already have problems getting people coverage for things like physical therapy. Nobody will take them. And so my concern is, one, you know, getting some of these crucial ancillary services that patients need, even after surgery or before surgery, that are needed. And also just, I know that a lot of doctors in the community are going to have trouble wanting to take these patients, because we even have trouble at some of the hospitals that I work at. I can't get them approved for surgery if they only have Medicare. I'm sorry, not Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, Denise, thank you. Betsy and Mulse, can you chime in on this about getting those extra services for people who are lower income, be that physical therapy or whatever?
Right. Well, I mean, for anyone who's had surgery knows that physical therapy is often not just an extra, but a really essential part of recovery and getting back to good health. And we are trying our best to ensure that as part of that essential health benefit or minimum coverage requirement through the legislation that we protect and we make sure that that's all in there. And that some of that will as well apply to Medicaid. So, you know, these questions are very much on our mind, and we're trying to look out for that. And if they are included in the package, then there should not be coverage questions, although, of course, we know the way healthcare always works, we need an appeal system as well in case there are denials or not a timely enough answer. So we have that as well built into the process.
And Andy Byman, a quick add-on I know you want to make, and then I promise Felix, so I got to get to him.
Yeah, so, I mean, an important part of all this that we need to acknowledge is that states get to set payment rates for the Medicaid program, and California historically has been close to the very bottom among all states, which is part of the very low participation rates in the program. The Affordable Care Act will require that primary care physicians see a payment bump to 100% of Medicare rates for 2013 and 2014, but this will not affect all providers in the Medicaid program, and something that will be critical for turning coverage into access is to make sure that the state of California pays provider rates that will encourage participation in the program.
And Felix, I've made you wait, and now I'm going to make you be brief. Sorry. Go ahead, please, though.
I'm going to be very, very brief. I have two questions. How is the Affordable Care Act is going to address the issue of inefficiency that is currently existing within the Medi-Cal and Medicare, where the patients are able to duplicate the services by going to several different providers? That's my first question. My second question is that when the organization, like, for example, like a hospital, like CPMC, when they're carrying a nonprofit status, can we obligate hospitals like that to accept patients based on the fact that their tax status is nonprofit?
Okay, Felix, great. Thanks for getting in those quick questions. Andy Beinman, quick answers.
Well, in terms of obligating hospitals that have not-for-profit status, it requires good accounting to make sure that we're able to hold them accountable. Those methods have not been ideal in doing that, but I think it's a critical thing to make sure that if they're getting a community benefit in terms of taxes, that we hold them accountable.
And inefficiency within the Medicaid system.
Yeah. So one of the things that Medicaid is doing toward its Bridge to Reform, which we talked about earlier, is it is moving more of the patients into integrated care delivery systems and managed care, and making sure that patients have an assigned primary care provider and a medical home. That's a key part of implementing this law. California is in the midst of that transition, but I think there are opportunities by getting patients based in primary care medical homes that we can make the system run more efficiently.
And very briefly, Betsy Imholtz, if people want to find out more to just sort of get their arms around where we're at with all of this, where would you direct them?
Well, our website has some stuff. Yourhealthsecurity.org is the healthcare part of our website. As I said, smallbusinessmajority.org for small business questions is great. The exchange itself, California Health Benefit Exchange, has a lot of information up there, some for the general public and some quite specific to see what the exchange is doing. And one note on that I would say is for people to really pay close attention, because it's likely that they'll come up with a new name, because exchange isn't exactly to the ears.
Okay, thank you. And Emily Bazar, I'm sure people can find out more also at the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting website. Thanks to you, thanks to Betsy Imholtz, and thanks to Dr. Andy Beinman, as well as Commissioner Dave Jones, for helping us begin to sort through all that is headed our way. Thanks all very much. Forum is produced by Tina Lorberg and Amy Machado. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.